Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The COVID-19 crisis has erased years of progress towards gender equality and highlighted the need for immediate action to take advantage of the transformative power of women in all walks of life, UN Chief Antonio Guterres said on Monday. In comments to mark International Women's Day on the 8th of March, the UN Secretary-General insisted that all countries should actively include women in their plans to prepare for the future after the pandemic has passed. A better future depends on addressing this power imbalance, Mr. Guterres insisted, in reference to the fact that men still outnumber women 3-1 in parliaments worldwide and in many other spheres.
When women lead in government, we see bigger investment in social protection and greater inroads against poverty. When women are in parliament, countries adopt more stringent climate change policies. When women are at the peace table, agreements are more enduring.
Mr. Guterres noted that the COVID-19 crisis has a women's face, as most essential frontline workers are women, before outlining how governments could help women and girls with specific measures such as boosting investment in childcare. The formal economy only works because it is subsidized by women's unpaid care work, the UN chief maintained. A fire at a migrant holding center in Yemen has killed at least 8 people and likely claimed the lives of many more, the UN Migration Agency IOM said on Monday. In an alert on Twitter, IOM Regional Director for the Middle East and North Africa, Carmela Godo, said that the agency had provided emergency health care for 170 people in the capital Sana'a. More than 90 were seriously hurt, Ms. Godo added, noting that the cause of the blaze remains unclear. Guards were also likely among the victims, she said. IOM will continue to monitor the situation and distribute food to those in need, Ms. Godo noted. This is just one of the many dangers that migrants have faced during the past 6 years of the crisis in Yemen, she said. All people, including migrants, should be afforded protection and safety. Despite years of conflict between the internationally recognized government of President Abdrabu Mansour Hadi and mainly Houthi militants who control Sana'a and beyond, the country remains a staging post for migrant workers from East Africa seeking work in the Gulf countries further north. IOM estimates that thousands of migrants have become stranded in Yemen after COVID-19 movement restrictions were imposed across the Gulf region and Horn of Africa states. An additional 10 million girls are at risk of child marriage over the next decade because of the impact of the coronavirus pandemic, the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, said on Monday. Henrietta Fore, UNICEF Executive Director, warned that COVID-19 has made an already difficult situation for millions of girls even worse. She explained that the pandemic had forced schools to shut, leaving children isolated from friends and support networks, and that the rising poverty and parental deaths caused by the coronavirus had heightened the risk of them marrying young. Before the outbreak of COVID-19, 100 million girls were at risk of child marriage in the next 10 years, the UN agency said, noting that girls who marry in childhood face immediate and lifelong consequences. These include a greater likelihood of experiencing domestic violence and dropping out of school. Teenage girls also face an increased risk of early and unplanned pregnancy, complications with childbirth and death. According to UNICEF, globally, an estimated 650 million girls and women alive today were married in childhood, with about half of those in Bangladesh, Brazil, Ethiopia, India, and Nigeria. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
We are inside our police patrol boat called Avies Tukoro.
In this final episode of Island Voices, we are starting out at sea. We are on board RVS Tukoro 102's patrol boat. I'm Sergeant Bianca Simeon, an assistant navigator and part of the team that performs fishery protection, search and rescue, and border patrols for Vanuatu. 11 years ago, I was the first woman recruited into the Vanuatu Police Maritime Wing. It was just me and 14 male recruits. I have a goal. One day, hopefully not too far away, I want to be in charge of this boat. Shortly, you are about to meet two other of my colleagues who, despite many challenges, are standing tall in chasing their goals. Inspector Lily Chowell, a 28 year career veteran, heads up the Family Protection Unit. And Sarah Bule Joseph, a new recruit, is one of the first women to join the Engineers Department within the Vanuatu Mobile Force.
Hi, my name is Lily Joel. I'm inspector from the Family Protection Unit. Today is my 28th year in service, and I'm really proud to be an inspector at the Family Protection Unit. And as you can see, my staffs are here. They're doing their job, doing the investigation. And from here, we move on to the Serious Crime Unit. The Serious Crime Unit is out from this floor. And this is the old CID unit from here to the end. Here we have the general duty officers. They are the first one who receive reports that come in. They are the first one to respond to any report that comes in. So we have the general duty officers. And from the downstairs, we have the general duty.
For me, the Vanuatu Police Force, my first day of training, just a bit nervous. I really love wearing uniform. But when I started the training, it becomes nervous because the trainings are hard. In my team, there were 60 of us. Out of the 60, 5 female, and the rest are boys.
My name is Sarah. My surname is Paula Joseph. I'm 24. I work at the VMF Engineers. I joined the Engineers unit at August 2019. Being with the Engineers is not that really easy. It's a typical unit, but we choose to come here because we want to learn things differently. And it's the first time Vanuatu Engineers, VMF Engineers, had 4 ladies with them for that long period. Yeah, 2 years now.
Hi, my name is Bianca Simeon. I'm from Santo Ambai, one of the northern islands from the northern province. I work for Maritime Police Maritime Wing, situated in Port Vila, the capital of Vanuatu. I work here in Police Maritime as a sergeant, position of assistant navigator on our police patrol boat, RVS Tukoro. We are here with 50 plus officers. Working on Police Maritime Wing. Police Maritime Wing is one of the 3 elements from the Vanuatu Police Force. We have our base, call it Mala Base, situated in the center of Port Vila. My first day in recruit, was a bit of a challenge because I'm the only female with all the male back in 10 years 2010. So for me it's a bit big challenge, so every day I have to think what it's going to be like, all the PTs and all the stuff's going on during our training in police college. The first week it's a bit harder, and then the following week I used to it.
In my recruit, there's 100 of us, 80 boys and 20 girls.
Mine, we did come in police maritime as a direct entry, so there's 15 of us and I'm the only lady. In my mind, I was like, okay, it's going to be a big challenge for me. The first day, I was a bit lonely, and I need backup from others.
courage. And I have to commitment to do my work to come up to where I was today. So it needs courage and commitment. And you have a goal. You have to work towards a goal.
Before I joined a police marathon, I was in the interest of doing all the stuff with machinery, especially on board, and also for the policing side. I like also to help community and people, and also secure our nation, and also enforce the law where the constitution too. Before entering the police college, I have a big dream ahead. I was thinking maybe it's a new step for me for getting in uniform and then helping communities, helping the nation, and also driving a ship. It's another dream I had.
For me, back in my school days, I really loved watching the uniform, how the police officers wearing the uniform. So I was thinking maybe one day I'll be in one of these uniforms. So my dream has come true.
I want to sign up because I want to get out of my comfort zone. So I was stuck in the house. My parents are strict. I don't have the independent. Yeah, even though I already turned 21, still I'm in the house. So I just want to get out from that corner and prove them I can do something.
So we have these three elements, and we have the Vanuatu police force, and we have the Vanuatu mobile force, and we have the Vanuatu maritime wing. So these are the three elements that work under one commissioner of police. I really love my job because I love investigating. With investigation, I met more people, new people, different cultures, and new places that I've never been before. Investigation had led me to these places and made new friends.
I'm the only one in the family who works at sea and also on board. So it's my own interest. I like to work with machineries and stuff.
Being an engineer, especially carpentry, you have to do with heights, cutting off timbers using heavy machines. But one thing, you have to be very careful with that. Me, for one, I'm afraid of heights, but being in the engineers, I did do a lot of climbing on top of the roof, so I get used to heights, because they always told me, you can't fall, you just have to climb and think positive. If you always think that, oh, I'm going to fall, then you're going to fall.
I love going out to sea. Sometimes at sea it's not everyday good weather, so we have also a rough weather, especially when you have cyclone season.
Maybe the worst one is in 2015, Cyclone Pam. Me, my dad, and my little brother, we were sitting at the living room and we were watching a movie, and he starts to make jokes and we were laughing, and there's no feeling of fright. Yeah. We're just sitting there when the power cuts, and we were scared running to him, and he started to laugh at the two of us.
I have a big story. I was there on board when we have cyclone bomb hitting us. So we were at Moso Island. I was really scared at the time. It's a dark We have our power plant on board.
Okay, as a single mom with 5 kids, I was at home with my kids, and when the cyclone comes, no one was with me as someone to help me with the kids.
The boat is like rolling side to side. Even if we talk to each other close range, we can hear us. Even we can't see outside. It's like a poor visibility. We just heard all the sounds of wind and swell hitting the ship side to side, and then we get rolling side to side too. So
it was like a nightmare, because it was my first time to experience such cyclone, and with category 5, all my kids were frightened, and we have to be only in one room because the other room was blown up, and really it was fear for all of us. I was always patient in what I do, because I know that comes a time when I'm going to get to where I want. I want to get to the senior level as a superintendent.
Yeah. One thing I learned is all about patience. You have to have patience in yourself. Whatever task comes, just accept it. Carry out the way your superior asks you to do. So as for me as a private, there's a long way yet to go.
No patience. I'm hardly had patience with me, but I do have confidence and always have faith, and always love doing my jobs every day. 5 years from now, I think I'm trying to push harder to go for commanding officer's chair.
In Vanuatu Mobile Force, we have only one mom, one lieutenant, which is a female officer. So yeah. I'll try my best to get to where she is.
That's the final episode of Island Voices from Vanuatu, brought to you by the United Nations Office of the High Representative for the Least Developed Countries, Landlocked Developing Countries, and Small Island Developing States. Our earlier episode, Saltwater Sister and That's Politics, are also live and ready and waiting for you to catch up. Island Voices was hosted today by me, Sergeant Bianca Simeon. Our podcast producer, mixer, and sound engineer is Jenny Sten from Blue Sky Vision Vanuatu. The series executive producer in New York are Damien Sass and Connell O'Loughlin. Big fella thank you to Nason Talio from Pango Village for his sweet music. Island Voices has been made possible through funding from the government of the Netherlands. Thank you for listening, and as we say around here, look in you.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. More than 1,600 people have received Ebola virus vaccinations in Guinea, where 4 have died in a new outbreak, but more life-saving jabs are needed to contain it, the UN Health Agency has said. To date, 18 Ebola cases have been reported in the West African nation, 14 confirmed and 4 deaths. According to the World Health Organization, WHO, only 30,000 Ebola vaccines are available out of a global stock of 500,000. A ring vaccination strategy has been employed to inhibit the spread of disease by vaccinating only those most likely to be infected. But there are concerns that if Ebola spreads outside Guinea, which shares a border with 6 other countries, there are only limited stocks of vaccines to respond. Here's Dr. Ibrahima Fall, Assistant Director General of WHO's Emergency Response Unit.
We are using the ring vaccination, meaning that we are vaccinating the contacts of cases, the contacts of contacts and probable contacts. So with this strategy, we are able to control this type of outbreak. But in the future, we need more vaccines.
Guinea's last Ebola outbreak started in 2014 and quickly spread to Liberia and Sierra Leone. It was the deadliest Ebola outbreak since the virus was first detected in 1976, with 28,000 cases and 11,000 deaths. Cases of COVID-19 more than doubled in the West Bank last month, likely a result of new, more contagious variants of the disease, the UN said on Friday, although infections fell in the Gaza Strip. According to an update from the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, more than 29,400 additional people in the occupied Palestinian territory tested positive for the new coronavirus in February. The total number of cases is more than 208,000, and nearly 190,000 people have recovered. Since the pandemic began, the disease has claimed more than 1,700 lives in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and 550 in the Gaza Strip. The proportion of deaths among confirmed cases remains at 1.1% in the occupied Palestinian territory, which is above Israel at 0.7%, but below Jordan at 1.2% and Egypt at 5.9%. The development follows the initial vaccination of thousands of key workers in the West Bank and Gaza following the donation of Moderna and Sputnik V shots, although a broader rollout of the inoculation campaign had to be halted because of delays in anticipated deliveries. The first vaccines delivered through the UN-partnered equitable scheme known as COVAX are expected to arrive in March. To Iran, finally, where the UN Human Rights Office has spoken out against the use of violence by security forces against unarmed protesters and fuel couriers from the Baloch minority working on the border with Pakistan. In an alert on Friday, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, said that at least 12 people had reportedly been killed, 2 of them children. Unrest began on the 22nd of February when Iranian Revolutionary Guards allegedly shot and killed at least 10 fuel couriers in Sistan and Balochistan province, on the border with Pakistan, said OHCHR spokesperson Rupert Colville. He added that this followed a 2-day standoff that was triggered by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, who had blocked the road to the city of Saravan. The killings reportedly triggered demonstrations in several cities across the province, where lethal ammunition was fired at protesters and bystanders, killing at least 2 more people and injuring several dozen others. Last year, Mr. Colville noted that 59 Kurdish couriers were reported to have been killed by border officials in provinces in the northwest of Iran. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
So on this International Women's Day, UN's focus is on women in leadership positions. When we talk about women in parliament across the world, what's the current representation of women and how would you describe the current situation?
There has been progress, that's for sure, in terms of women's participation in parliament. Worldwide, we can see advancement, especially since the adoption of the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action. The world's proportion of women in parliament has increased from 11.3% in 1995 to 25.5% today. There has been an increase also in Asia, where the proportion of women in parliament stood at 13.2% in 1995, and stands today at 20.4%. So, of course, we can see progress, and progress is welcome. However, when we look at the ultimate objective, which is to have equality in representation among men and women everywhere, we are far, far away from reaching this gender parity in representation in parliament.
If we talk about South Asia, we've seen a number of women PMs and presidents in India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, yet the ratio of women in top leadership positions remains very, very low. What is the reason, according to you, for such low representation of women in politics across the region?
Well, women face many challenges to be both elected or appointed into leadership positions. We know from our end, our data at the IPU shows that when it comes to women speakers of parliament, so women leaders of parliamentary institutions, globally, they are only 20.8%. So you see that the problem is a global one and not only a regional one. In Asia, the proportion of women who preside over a parliamentary chamber is at 15.9%. And women speakers in Bangladesh, Indonesia, Japan, Laos, People's Republic, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, or Vietnam. Women are, you know, face a multitude of barriers and challenges in taking leadership positions at the level of the state, at the level of the government, at the level of the parliament. Although there are some, you know, indications that, you know, women's leadership comes with some very much needed changes and novelties on the political agenda, and we're seeing very strong women leaders showing great impact through their leadership, including in this COVID-19 pandemic. Still, women are far, far away from having equal access to leadership positions. There is a lack of political will to have, you know, women lead. There are also challenges related to perceptions and stereotypes against women. There are also challenges related to discrimination in the law, in opportunities, and a big challenge that we are seeing more and more documenting as well, more and more. It is a challenge that women face in politics, and that is the sexism, harassment, and violence against women in the political sphere.
When you're talking about challenges, with the coming of social media now, how has the scenario changed in recent years? And are women facing harassment on the social media platforms now? And is that a reason for more and more women that they're not able to survive in public roles more and more?
Yes, absolutely. Attacks against women on social media are rampant. Such attacks also target young women at the start of their aspirations, be it as advocates or as political aspirants. This phenomenon has a great impact. It prevents women from pursuing a political career. It prevents them from engaging in a political career. And the situation is pretty dangerous for democracy, and this is everywhere. Violence against women in politics exists outside of the social media or outside of the online world, let's say. It is there in different forms. Psychological violence is very high, but also intimidation, threat, and sexual violence, as well as physical violence. And all these types or forms of violence are also present on social media in one form or the other. But they all aim at one objective, which is to silence women and to hinder or limit or completely eliminate their participation in the political arena.
Why do you think it's important for women to take on political roles more and more? Where are the gaps, and how can we achieve more gender parity in positions of power?
Women's political participation is extremely important in terms of democracy, first and foremost. For the Interparliamentary Union, and this stands since 1997, as the Interparliamentary Union adopted the Universal Declaration on Democracy, which stated that there can be no democracy without a genuine partnership between men and women in the conduct of political affairs. Women's participation is also extremely important for efficiency. It's very clear that policies and legislation and the political debate and any decisions that can be taken at the political level would miss the perspectives of half of the population, right? Most often women form at least 50% or about 50% of the population anywhere. So when you have decisions that impact the lives of everyone, including these 50% women, taken without the meaningful participation, contribution, leadership of women, there is inevitably a gap. Women come into politics with talents, experiences, life experiences, professional experiences that are different of the experiences that men bring in politics and in our political institutions.
Can you give us some examples of good practices across the world that can be role models for other nations?
We've seen in many parts of the world not only gender electoral quotas being adopted with a target of a minimum of 30% of women in parliament, for example, but what we've seen also, interestingly, is a shift in many countries in recent years towards enhancing these measures, evolve towards targets that place the cursor on parity, on, you know, 50-50. And you can see today that the two regions of the world that have reached regionally the proportion of 30% women in parliaments are precisely Latin America and Europe. So progress can be achieved, and such experiences show that it is possible to achieve such progress. Most recently, even in regions where women's participation faces quite a lot of challenges, such as the Middle East and North African region, where we've seen some countries like the United Arab Emirates adopting measures to have a parliament made of 50% men and 50% women. So it is possible. It definitely takes political will to place the objective of equality in political participation high on the agenda, combat against sexism, harassment, and violence against women in parliament and in politics is also extremely important, and it is definitely a priority.
How is IPU working towards ensuring more participation of women in politics to bridge the gender gap in positions of power?
IPU is a very strong promoter of gender parity in parliaments. Our work with the World Parliament aims at building the political will by showing the importance of women's political participation. Our work is also the one of an observatory of progress in women's participation. So we collect information and data, and we make this information and data available to support policy making in the area of increasing women's participation, in particular in parliament, but more broadly in politics. We also have programs that support legal drafting for women's participation, including, for example, legal drafting to reform electoral legislation. We are also very active as the World's Organization of Parliaments with parliaments where women's political participation is facing challenges. We raise awareness. We encourage and facilitate peer-to-peer exchanges of good practices and solutions to enhance women's political participation. We also support parliaments in their efforts to legislate for gender equality and to be more gender-sensitive institutions and hence more gender-responsive.
It's gratifying to know that I survived for a purpose in order to enhance and help perfect an imperfect world. That really has been my mission.
Welcome to In Their Words, Surviving the Holocaust, Finding Hope, a podcast preserving the testimonies of those who survived the atrocities committed by the Nazis and their racist collaborators in the 1930s and 1940s. and who shared their stories at United Nations Holocaust commemorative events around the world, reminding us of the human cost of hate and our responsibility to fight injustice. Some survivors have agreed to join us for an in-depth conversation. This is the story of Rabbi Arthur Schneier. Rabbi Schneier still remembers the evening his childhood synagogue was engulfed by flames, just a young boy when Nazi Germany invaded his native Austria. The destruction of his house of worship was part of the November pogrom, or the Night of Broken Glass, in November of 1938. The Nazi state organized demolition and plundering of Jewish homes and businesses signaled an escalation of cruel treatment toward Jews in Europe. For Rabbi Schneier, the incident is a stinging reminder of the consequences of hate left unchecked. He has committed his life to keep that history from being repeated. At 9 years old, Rabbi Schneier and his mother fled to Hungary the following year and lived through the Nazi occupation in Budapest, during which he had several close encounters with death, but managed to escape them all. Now approaching his 91st birthday, Rabbi Schneier has spent more than 60 years in leadership on behalf of religious freedom, coexistence, and human rights, largely through the Appeal of Conscience Foundation, the Interfaith Coalition, of which he is founder and president, in addition to his day-to-day obligations as senior rabbi at New York City's historic Park East Synagogue. For his decades of commitment to promoting peace, he has been the recipient of numerous awards and recognitions, including high honors from 10 countries, 11 honorary doctorates, and was conferred papal knighthood. He tells us how his experience as a Holocaust survivor sparked a lifetime of work toward overcoming societal division and hatred.
I'm Rabbi Arthur Schneier, born March 20, 1930 in Vienna, Austria, and arrived in New York City on May 8, 1947.
If you could briefly describe your childhood in Vienna before the war, what was that like?
I was the only child, and unfortunately lost my dad at the age of six. He died in 1936, so my mother brought me up. I attended school in Vienna and had many non-Jewish friends who came to my home, and we played soccer together, we went to the movies together. Celebrated various holidays, and then after the Nazis took over, I became a pariah. And not because the friends of mine had any animosity. They were taught by their parents, do not have anything to do with this Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I always say, children are not born with hatred, they're taught how to hate.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What sort of anti-Semitic measures do you remember affecting you as a child?
Well, first of all, if I wanted to buy ice cream in an ice cream parlor, Jews and dogs would not want it. I could not wear my lederhosen because I was Jewish. The dehumanization of that really started with the attack on Jewish stores, keeping Jews out of schools, universities. But above all, I had to give up my place in public school, which was in my neighborhood, because we were assigned to a school reserved only for Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to walk all the way to the first district in order to attend classes.
Mm-hmm.
And then worry about being beaten up by the Hitlerjugend on my way home. So what I did, I would always try to make sure that I would walk near an adult in order to prevent an onslaught. Also, no attendance at soccer games, movies, just being excluded. The greatest impact was really Kristallnacht.
How do you remember Kristallnacht, the November pogrom?
I remember this was Thursday night. During the night, plundering of Jewish apartments, the beating up of Jews, pulling many of the men out for further deportations to Dachau, the concentration camp. And then the next day, on Friday, on my way to school, passing by my synagogue, saw the firemen and policemen rejoicing at the burning of the synagogue, my synagogue, only concerned about the saving the neighboring buildings. Unfortunately, when I return to Vienna now, that synagogue doesn't exist. There's an apartment house in place.
And you were 8 years old at this point.
That's correct.
How did that feel to see your synagogue in flames?
It has stayed with me for the rest of my life. And that's why I identify whenever a church or a mosque or a synagogue is attacked, I do have a reflex, a recall, seeing my own house of worship in flames. And that's why I made my point to fight what I consider an attack on the jugular faith of any community attacking their house of worship.
As the situation in Vienna grew increasingly unstable, a young Rabbi Arthur and his widowed mother fled Austria in September of 1939 to be with his grandparents. They arrived in Budapest in hopes of acquiring a U.S. visa with no success, and their tourist status in Hungary eventually expired. 9-year-old Arthur and his mother survived the Holocaust, but living in hiding was not easy. He recalls successfully hiding in an unexpected place, thanks to arrangements made by his grandparents to shield him from the threat of deportation by Hungary's military gendarme.
June 1941. My grandfather had a very good friendship with the chief of police, and he sent two policemen to warn my grandparents to hide me because the gendarmes were going to pick me up for deportation. And so my grandparents arranged for me to stay with a in a peasant's home, but not in this house. For close to 2 months, I stayed with the cows and horses. My grandmother used to bring me food every day, every second day. I remember going through the gardens, and they had the wire fences. So when we were told that the deportations are halted, I ventured back through the gardens from one house to the other. And I was stuck on the gate for an hour. And that was very fortunate, because had I arrived earlier, the gendarmes again came looking for me.
In March of 1944, a year before the end of the Second World War, German troops moved into Hungary. With the takeover of fascist leader Ferenc Szálasi in October, terror for Jews intensified. In November 1944, when Arthur was 14, Szálasi's extremist Arrow Cross group selected him to march to the Austrian border. For all intents and purposes, a march of death. However, a twist of fate would save Arthur.
So they made every man and woman 14 to 66 to 60 on death marches through Hungary to the Austrian border. Many of them never made it. And we were lined up, and that's when I had my sugar reserve. I filled my pockets with a lump of sugar. And one of the young fascists, Hungarian, came over, cut my pants, and I was left with 4 pieces of sugar. And then we were held outdoors at the East Railroad Station for several days, and I rationed myself, knowing that we would not get any food at all. Then a miracle happened. The Hungarian Szalasi government wanted recognition by the Vatican, Sweden, Switzerland. They made an agreement that they will establish diplomatic relations, provided that they would have some safety houses. And all those who got the safety pass would be able to be in those places. That's when I end up with the Swiss safety pass in a building also run by the International Red Cross, which happened to be my school building. And this is where I was liberated.
Rabbi Schneier was liberated in 1945 by Russian troops. He went on to finish high school in Vienna and arrived in New York City 2 years later, where he enrolled at Yeshiva University and began the educational journey that would lead him toward his peace-seeking path. Rabbi Schneier did not take his survival for granted, but rather his witness to the dangers of hate and disregard for human life ignited a sense of responsibility in the fight for religious protection and civic and societal peace. Over the decades, he has convened meetings to bring relief to the suffering around the globe, from seeking religious freedom in Cuba to advocating for the release of victims from the clandestine detention centers of Argentina's infamous Dirty War. Rabbi Schneier says the worrying trend of rising global anti-Semitism and general hostility will be overcome, but it will require a unified effort.
That's why I made it a point in lobbying successfully. Through the Appeal of Conscience Foundation, a protection of religious sites resolution in 2001, which was adopted by the United Nations. In 2005, the United Nations adopted International Holocaust Remembrance Day, January 27, which was really the liberation of Auschwitz, which, by the way, is the graveyard of my grandparents and most of my family. I want to visit the synagogue, a cemetery. I go to Auschwitz. So that was a very important decision in terms of reminding the world of the potential of evil. And Holocaust survivors, and there are very few of us, you know, we are a diminishing tribe. We're the eyewitnesses. We saw the man's capacity to do evil. You hate Jews, that's only the beginning. You can be certain that will be followed by racism, followed by Islamophobia, Christianophobia. It's an experience that has to be encountered in order to understand how first dehumanization of a group of people can lead not only to the burning of houses of worship, but also to the burning of human beings.
Seeing rising anti-Semitism and intolerance, are you optimistic about how future generations will handle this?
I firmly believe that every conflict comes to an end. The problem that we have today, we are in the midst of a societal upheaval, all kinds of technological changes. Whenever you have a crisis, societal changes, economic hardship, any kind of upheaval, and whenever you have extremes taking the place of the center, then that is a fertile ground for hatred, any type of bigotry. So I think we shall overcome this one too, but unless we take united action, united against anti-Semitism, united against Christianophobia, united against racism, united, my favorite saying, united we prevail. If we're not united, we fail.
Certainly. And on that topic of unison and operating as a collective, you've succeeded in many civic and religious engagement efforts to bring relief to those suffering. What is the key from your perspective to communicating with those that are perhaps across the proverbial table?
First, you have to establish trust in one another. And that happens based on personal contact and dialogue,
mm-hmm.
and diplomacy. And that has really been my key. What you have to do is show the other side to search for a common ground that is beneficial to both. So yes, there is time for change, but you have to work at it. Also, I must say, because I lived through the Holocaust myself, you'll find that every society has some people who are righteous, and I owe my life to, yes, the Red Army that liberated Budapest and the ghetto,
mm-hmm.
and a Swiss consul general who made it his point to save thousands of Jews by issuing Swiss safety passes. That's why it's so important that we recognize those, and there were many, many people who show their humanity by welcoming their neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had others who were ready to deliver their neighbors and just take over all their possessions,
mm-hmm.
by handing them over to the henchmen. And I think that's a very important lesson, particularly for the younger generations. Join the League of the Righteous, not those who are trying to undermine civility and humanity. I personally made a pledge, thanking God every day for having survived, paying back by my work into religious cooperation, peace-seeking, not tolerance. I don't like the word tolerance. Tolerated means you're superior, and the one you tolerate is second-class citizen. I use the term mutual acceptance and respect. Love your neighbor as yourself.
Can I ask you why you chose to become a rabbi?
That's a very good question. My grandfather, Rabbi Moses Bergman, was a very, very prominent rabbi in Hungary. And when my mother and I fled to Hungary, he became my second father. Tall, blue eyes, scholarly, highly respected. My grandfather was really a victim in the crematoria of Auschwitz. I said, whatever I will do in life, I will study in his memory to be ordained as a rabbi. Had I remained in Vienna, I doubt whether this would have been the case. My ambition was to become a psychiatrist. And then the president of Yeshiva University said to me, you know, you're going to treat 30 patients as a psychiatrist, maximum 40. You have a potential to be a leader. Before I had my ordination, 6 months before, he just assigned me to fill a pulpit in Flatbush, Brooklyn. And the rest of the story is I practice psychology and psychiatry on the international scene.
After more than half a century of commitment to peace building, Rabbi Schneier, also known as a rabbi/diplomat, says his agenda is busier than ever. He expresses an immense gratitude for his survival and says the international recognition he has amassed over the years is confirmation he continues to fulfill his purpose in serving his community and the world.
I just celebrated my 90th birthday. Actually, it was March 12th. last year.
Mm-hmm.
And the celebration took place at the United Nations headquarters, and this was just at the outbreak of the pandemic.
Mm.
I received messages from the President of the United States, Pope Benedict, Pope Francis, the Ecumenical Patriarch, all the people I've had dealings with over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very gratifying that if I survived, then it's gratifying to know that I survived for a purpose, in order to enhance and help perfect an imperfect world.
Mm.
That really has been my mission. I'm grateful every day that I'm still, thank God, active, busier than ever before, and also trying to not only do my own share, but transmitting the challenge, which, again, I think is so reassuring, that after we're gone, the witnesses to the Holocaust, that horrible tragedy, there is a not only the Jewish community, but you have the United Nations outreach program that will continue to keep that flame alive. A question I posed to Secretary General at the last year's International Holocaust Remembrance Service. I'm always concerned. My synagogue was filled with Holocaust survivors, sometimes three or four rows. Today, there's only one row left. What's going to happen after we're gone? With Holocaust denial and all kinds of conspiracy theories, who is going to remember? And the Secretary General said, we will remember. And that's very reassuring.
Rabbi Steiner, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank
All
you.
The best to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Rabbi Arthur Schneier, Holocaust survivor and international leader in religious freedom and coexistence. This has been, in their words, Surviving the Holocaust, Finding Hope, a podcast by the United Nations Holocaust Outreach Program. To find out more about the organization's Holocaust Remembrance and Educational Program and how you can participate, visit www.un.org/en/Holocaust Remembrance. I'm Natalie Hutchison. Thanks for listening.